From the recognized Temple of Excellence in Networking and Security, Healthy Paranoia, comes the match of the century, the IPv6 Smackdown. In the red corner, introducing the ultimate network warriors and unicorn hunters with a professional record of 2 to the 128 wins and 0 losses. Freestyle fighters Ethan the Ripper Banks and introducing Jim Killer Small. About to enter the ring in the blue corner, the challengers from Argentina, eminent security researcher Fernando Gaunt, tag teaming with respected subject matter virtuoso Joe Klein. Judging this event, an IPv6 cast of experts, including Eric Vink, Scott Hogg, TJ Evans. I'll be your announcer and referee, Mrs. Y. The following contest will be judged under the traditional rules of Australian nerd wrestling, which means that the match can be won by pinning your opponent to the mat for 30 minutes while he watches the vendor PowerPoint presentation. Also by submission, disqualification, or a stream of clever technical insults. So let's get ready to rumble. Okay, let's get some introductions going because we have some new people on the recording today that we haven't normally had before. Of course, we have my colleague Ethan Banks.
Hey, Michelle, how are you today? It's a beautiful sunny day here in New Hampshire, and I had family here, and then they were gone, and I was able to put a headset on and join the call, which is pretty cool.
I am so excited to have you here because I don't know what I'd do without you. And we have some new people joining us. I'd like to get everybody to tell us a little bit about themselves. First, we have Eric Vink from the lovely country of Belgium.
Absolutely, and today was perfectly lovely because it's Sunday and the sun was shining, most of it the last time of the year. It's 9 p.m. for me, so a little bit asleep, but perfectly fine, specifically on this topic of IPv6 security.
And Eric,
and basically, I'm working for Cisco. Yes.
Right, yeah, just wanted to get that in there. Scott?
Hi, I'm Scott, Director of Technology Solutions at GTRI, a system integration company here in sunny Denver, Colorado.
And TJ?
My name is TJ Evans. I'm a Director of Networking at a small IPv6 focused company by the name of Nepho6. Been doing V6 for 6 or 7 or so years now, and a little bit of everything we can.
And Jim.
Hi, Michelle. Ethan. I work for a large solutions provider doing consulting for networking and security.
And we have Joe. Did I get Joe? Joe Klein?
Not yet.
Go ahead, Joe.
Joe Klein, security researcher and scientific hooligan. Basically, I've been playing with IPv6 as a researcher for the last over 10 years. Doing lots in it. Actually, my newest research is interesting. IPv6 with the Internet of Things. Ooh. Anyway.
And finally, we have Fernando. Fernando, you still
okay,
there?
Okay. Yeah. Hi, everyone. I'm Fernando Gont. I'm based in Buenos Aires, Argentina. We're having a sunny but very humid day today. And I work for SI6 Networks. I have been working for the last few years on some IPv6 security projects for the Center for the Protection of National Infrastructure of the UK.
Wow, that's great. Now, we have a lot of people on, and, you know, I did this because I know there's a lot to say. An article came out recently. Security expert Mark Hoyce, I think that's how you say his name. And he basically said, if some network engineer says, let's make a global company all IPv6, I would fire that guy because it costs millions and the benefit is zero. Let's say you're Daimler. In what way does it make your network better? I'll put a link to the article in the show notes, but I wanted to start the conversation with that because I know everybody here has a different, very different opinions about IPv6 and deployment. And I think it's important for us to get some practical advice, and some, for the Pack and Pushers listeners, because I think this, you know, people are starting to come to engineers and saying, you know, we want to start deploying IPv6 and people need some good information.
I'll start with that, Michelle. So I've done a lot of research on this, especially recently. And the first thing I'd point out is if we look at the internet, we have, as of today, about 129 million IPv4 addresses left in the free pool. And if we look at the last 12 months before that, the only reason we only went through 200 million addresses is because APNIC ran out, and therefore we didn't basically made it hard for anybody in Asia to get more addresses. So if we look at that, it's kind of clear that we don't have a lot of time left before drastic things start happening. So that in combination of, if you look specifically in the U.S., we're already to a 1.5% penetration rate, which is 1 in 67 people. So it's not a lot, but if you ask any marketing department, hey, what do you think about ignoring 1 in 67 of our potential customers, I don't think they'd go for it. So, and finally, the last thing I would say is if you look at a large company, particularly somebody like Daimler, the challenge is that there's a lot of companies like Google, Microsoft, Cisco that have publicly shown what they did to roll out IPv6. And you're talking about something that takes years, even with the best network engineers in the world. So if you look at where we're at with free addresses remaining, and you look at how much work it is to deploy it, I think it's pretty hard to defend a stance of saying, you know, you shouldn't even start. And even Mark, we talked about this on Fernando's IPv6 hackers list, and even Mark said he was misquoted, and that's not what he meant.
Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of people just saw that ZDNet article, and they weren't on the IPv6 hackers list. So, you know, you're going to get people at the C-level who saw that and didn't see the follow-up discussion, which I thought was very good. And I like your point. In fact, Ripe made an announcement on September 14th, this past Friday, that said that they distributed the last blocks of IPv4 address space from the available pool. And so what's going on? I mean, there obviously people are running out, are we just all in a state of denial? Is that what's going on with the general public?
I think the challenge is there was also an article on ZDNet by somebody saying, oh, well, if we look at AFRINIC, they have enough addresses till 2019, so therefore there's plenty of time and I don't have to worry. And the problem is you really need to look, and I'm sure everybody knows about Jeff, I think it's Houston, apologies if I'm saying his name wrong, but if you look at his Poteroo.net site, it has a fantastic set of statistics. And the challenge is you really have to look at IPv4 as an aggregate, because what's happened is we already allow transfers between ARIN and APNIC. And if you look at the vast majority of the demand for IP addresses on the internet, it's coming from China and India. So by allowing more allocations and more transfers and having an address market where we facilitate transferring addresses to the Asian region, it seems like it's actually going to make things worse. And so, you know, as we continue to dwindle the supply, we can't look at Africa because that's only accounting for local demand. But as we make it more of a global market, which is the direction we're moving in, you have to look at all addresses as a whole. And right now we're going through about a /8 or almost 17 million addresses a month. So when people talk about having all this time, I think they're not really aware of the reality of the situation.
What does everybody else think? What does everyone else think about that?
One comment we're throwing out here, which is there's a difference between having your internet edge being IPv6 enabled and your global internal network infrastructure being IPv6 enabled. And I think when you look at Mark's quote, or he was misquoted perhaps, there's a really big distinction to be made there in that you can put IPv6 out of the edge and still be IPv4 internally and still have some viable connectivity to the IPv6 internet and those potential customers that may be talking to you.
Yeah, Daimler has a business reason why they would want IPv6 at their internet edge. They would want their cars, you know, in their models to be viewed by the largest population of people on the internet that would be using IPv4 and or IPv6. In their internal networks, that's what Mark is referring to, in his internal networks of that company, they may or may not need to be IPv6 capable, but their employees would need to access, you know, things on the internet, content on the internet that could be V4 or V6 enabled. And they probably do business with companies all over the world, parts, suppliers, vendors, showrooms, stores, you know, what have you. and they're going to want to communicate with the broadest population of people on the earth. And so that means you're going to want, you know, that company is going to want to do both protocols and be able to speak both languages.
So are people...
The other thing is that the Internet of Things rollout, one of the protocols that we're seeing all the car manufacturers looking at is WAVE, which is part of what the U.S. Department of Transportation and other people call the ITS, which is the Intelligent Transportation System. Those are basically the ability for the car manufacturers to touch those via an IP address remotely. Right now, there's not enough addresses just to support the vehicles around the world, so they're already looking at IPv6 to be able to connect into those cars to provide updates, recommendations, and entertainment systems. So this is actually a business case that I'm seeing throughout the whole transportation industry.
Oh, okay, so let's make a distinction. So are we saying then that you need to look at whether or not, if it's an organization, then you're looking at probably transition mechanisms to start. And if you're looking at, you know, Internet of Things, like IP-enabled bathtubs and cars, et cetera, that you're probably looking at that straight IPv6. Is that what we're saying?
Well, let me take that, Michelle. So
okay.
there's a couple different use cases. So like Joe said, with the Internet of Things, it's hard to see how you could use anything but if you look at the scale you're talking about. But I would say I don't think anybody's advocating that, you know, you should go IPv6 only internally. It's more that you need it on your edge, and you need to be standing up a lab or a test network to start ramping up your expertise. So I wouldn't say there's a rush to deploy it internally, but I disagree with the stance that you should only do it at the edge, because you need to build up your operational expertise in terms of how am I going to secure it, how am I going to roll it out, how am I training my people to make sure they know how to troubleshoot it and all those things.
Sure, I agree with that. So, but I guess my point was, to start, the first stage for most organizations that are people recommending that the first stage be edge and then do transition, but while at the same time you're developing and you're practicing and gaining expertise in a lab?
Yes.
And I think so as well. But and don't forget that IPv6 is already there. As soon as you install Windows Vista,
sure,
Windows 2008, you have V6. And in the very deep core of any data center, there are machines or VMs running Windows 2008 that do run V6 for replication mirroring because they use link local. So basically they link local on the LAN only V6. So V6 is there.
Which makes Fernando very happy, right?
And yeah, so I think that one of the one thinks about Mark's statement regarding whether to deploy V6 or not. Probably he came from being a security guy. He essentially said that, well, if you really have a reason to deploy it, you should do it. But if you cannot find a real reason, real motivation for that, you shouldn't. And that's essentially the argument that the more pieces that you include into the puzzle, well, there are more things that can fail, right? So I think that whether you deploy it in a network or not usually varies from one case to another. And I don't think that there is like a one-size-fits-all answer regarding where you deploy V6 or where you wouldn't. In some cases, it might be sensible to deploy V6 just to gain experience, whereas in other cases, probably the most, extreme or ridiculous case could be like a military operations network in which obviously you wouldn't deploy anything unless you really need it.
I think something a lot of places overlook is that there is no universal truth here, right? How and why and when V6 needs to come into what parts of your organization really depend on a lot of factors, right? There isn't a convenient 30-second soundbite elevator pitch here that will provide or prompt, right, V6 to be deployed in a meaningful fashion. It's a longer conversation than that.
But I think we all agree that as soon as we introduce Linux or Windows 2008 in the data center or the intranet, IPv6 security becomes a real concern, or should have become a real concern from everyone.
I agree.
The thing that I'm seeing, and I see this where I've seen heard this from EDU environments, and I've heard this from places, different organizations that I've talked to, it's like, oh, we're just going to turn it on and see what happens. You know, it's not a big deal. Everybody's making making this bigger than it is. I mean, how do you guys respond to that?
Can I quote Rita Perlman?
Sure. I'd love for you to.
It's funny, if I go all the way back to 2000 and look at Radia Perlman's Interconnections book, she argued that IPv6 is, or CLNP is closer to IPv4 than IPv6. So I don't want to scare people off. There are a lot of similarities, but it really is a distinct protocol, and I'm a big advocate of you at least need to get it running in a lab, because you need to build up your operational knowledge. And I think we also agree that CGN or large scale NAT sucks. And the more everybody drags their feet to deploy IPv6, even if we look right now, if you look at UVerse, it's CGN. And if you look at the study done by Cable Labs, and Scott, thank you for sharing the links to the North American IPv6 Summit where this was covered, Cable Labs did a big study and has shown that it's a significantly degraded user experience. So that's the other thing nobody's talking about. By stalling with IPv6, we're essentially forcing all the carriers to deploy CGN and degrade everybody's experience, and also severely degrade security and make things harder to troubleshoot. So I think it's important to mention that there's consequences for inaction.
And I think it's pretty important indeed to say that CGN is a real security threat, because you are hiding yourself among a community of 1,000 or 10,000 users. And CGN or LSN impact on security cannot be minimized here. I think it's a real threat.
Also, right. The potential denial of service for outbound connections. There are some strategies to drop the CGM if you're on their network, because there is only so many connections outbound that one of the CGN devices support.
Well, what about you're saying that CGN is a security issue. Can you give me a threat model for that?
The issue is more along the lines of increasing the anonymity of a hacker behind a carrier-grade NAT system. Now it's much more difficult to do tracebacks of that IP address to the source that might be generating, you know, some malicious traffic or a system, you know, like that. So it increases this anonymity, which makes, you know, hackers be able to generate packets towards sites or do denial of service attacks, not be able to track things back.
I think there's two sides to that, Scott. One is attribution, as you were saying. The other thing is inbound. Essentially, with all these people with ports open, the ability to scan one IP address is relatively easy to identify open ports, open protocols. So essentially, it becomes a lot easier of attack surface for someone to get in and, you know, cause some real havoc on that network.
And there's also the thing that, of course, the CGN introduces a single point of failure, right? So it makes, like, a very interesting target for an attacker. Just taking down one device, they might be taking down lots and lots of users.
Yeah, agreed.
Overall availability, absolutely.
Exactly.
Right. So, you know, this is difficult then. So you're saying we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't, in a way. I mean, we're not really, and maybe this is part of the problem. Maybe people are in denial because they just feel overwhelmed by the whole prospect of moving to a new protocol, and they're grasping firmly onto NAT, and that's already causing security problems, but then they're not educated enough about IPv6, so the transition is stagnant and very slow. I mean, what do you do? What do you do to recommend it?
It's not just a matter of education, though. I mean, there's feature parity is one of the recurring themes I see coming up, is why folks are not really able to do a full IPv6 deployment. They'll say, I can't do everything with IPv6 that I can do with IPv4 yet, and therefore that stops me from deploying v6. So there's more to the story.
Yeah, I agree.
This is right. Sorry. For the intranet, but for the internet edge, I do believe really that there are enough features, even security features, that you can kind of safely deploy IPv6 on the internet edge to bypass the CGN issue. And it's way more secure to deploy safely IPv6 on the internet edge than to rely on CGN done by a remote CGN somewhere on the other side of the earth. Because the IPv6 transition technique that you deploy, like NAT64 or server load balancing 64, at your own internet edge that you manage, is much more secure than relying on a NAT.
Can you go into detail on that? I mean, can you be specific, for example?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Let's assume I'm from Belgium, right? So, and we are, as you know, RIPE, as you said, as closely the pool. So my own service provider, which is a challenger one, is growing, and he can only get 1,000 addresses, a /22 IPv4 addresses for the rest of his life, meaning that he will have to put cities, 10,000 of people, 1,000 of people, behind a single IPv4 address. Now, if there is, it's enough for one single guy behind this shared IPv4 address to launch a DOS attack, that's starting, for instance, starting thousands of SSL sessions against the e-banking system, then the e-banking system will shut down this specific IPv4 address, shutting down the attack, of course, shutting down 10,000 customers.
Right.
That's a big issue. That's what's
happening. You also have the issue of a single IP address. One bad person on that single IP address could cause everybody on that IP address to be blacklisted.
Exactly.
But, you know, I feel really personally frustrated by some of the issues with the security issues with IPv6. I mean, yeah, if I'm doing it at the edge, at least I don't have to deal with the security issues of Slack and RA guard and stuff like that. I mean, because I'm frustrated by some of the vendor responses to Slack attacks.
But to be a little more fair, right, you do still have to deal with them. You've got Windows 7 machines in your environment. You've got Windows Vista. You've got more recent Mac OS X, et cetera, et cetera. The better way to mitigate a lot of those concerns is to actually have a honest-to-goodness managed V6 deployment and have your gear and infrastructure understand and how to inspect and handle V6 versus putting your head in the sand and just hoping that it doesn't show up.
So what do you say to – so what if I manage the desktops and I just say, you know what, I'm going to just turn off IPv6 on all the desktops?
There's a challenge with that, though, because Microsoft would not support you as a prime example. And this is something
exactly
I've run into. So that's not really the stance you want to take. And even though if you look at, you know, Fernando has some fantastic presentations explaining how the RA fragmentation attack works. Even though in theory you could DOS somebody, in reality, if you talk to people like, you know, Thomas from Brno University that have deployed it, that's not what they see. They see more, you know, people, you know, accidentally leaving ICS on in Vista, and you have to have it to prevent them essentially having a rogue DHCP server is almost the closest analogy.
Right.
You know, and even though it's true that if you look at the defenses for IPv6, they're not quite there, although they're really close. You know, I would say if you look at a typical enterprise, how many of them do you think use things like DHCP guard or dynamic ARP inspection or IP source guard? I mean, there are a few, but it's certainly nowhere close to the majority. So I think saying that we can't deploy IPv6 because we don't have all of that perfect, I'm not buying it. I think it's a convenient excuse. I mean, you need to set up a lab and you need to build up your operational expertise. I mean, it's the future. And there's lots of great resources to help get you going. You got to start the journey.
Yeah, security practitioners sleep well at night today with the ARP related attacks that are fully available on their networks today. It only takes an attacker to leverage one compromised system on that internet facing DMZ to then create those, you know, neighbor discovery protocol attacks against the other systems that are on that same, you know, LAN.
Now
the header cap's been updated, it makes it even easier.
Yeah, I mean, I hear what you guys are saying. However, you know, in my former role at an EDU, we leveraged DHCP Snoop and things like that very heavily. So let's talk about the stuff that is specifically problematic that maybe engineers starting to roll out IPv6 can actually look at, which... the first thing is RA guard, that you know, let's talk about that and what that will, you know, they're like, I don't know, what does that mean? Why do I need that? So if you're using Slack, if you're for auto configuration of clients, then you need to enable RA Guard.
Not even if you're using Slack.
No. collision alert.
So under any sort of normally functioning V6 network segment, you would expect the router or routers to send router advertisements at the very least under, again, normal circumstances. There are exceptions. But under normal circumstances, so that hosts automatically learn, say, default gateway information, right? That has nothing to do with Slack per se. That's just the router sending RAs like you would expect it to. And that's one of the – I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, and you're right. I was just simply seconding you there. Even if you're using DHCP, you still need arrays to run the router. Exactly. DHCP in V6 doesn't send the route information. Big difference compared to V4.
Router advertisement guard would also be useful. Let's say that if you are, if your strategy so far is to, let's say, disable V6 support in your local network, that could be useful to actually block router advertisements so that it's impossible, it would be less possible for an attacker to actually trigger V6 connectivity by sending spoof router advertisements. So it's not just useful for, let's say, V6 enabled networks, but nowadays if you have a V4 enabled network, you'd probably benefit from using router advertisement guard.
I like the choice of the word less possible. I like that.
I know. I heard how he corrected himself.
I know from a security standpoint, we deal with trust models, and a couple of the trust models that you probably need to understand is, first, you're dealing with the broadcast trust model at layer 2. You're dealing with the layer 2 IP trust model, and then you're dealing with a naming trust model. All that has been interspersed in this conversation. The layer 2 trust model, you're really talking about 802.1x, the version from 2010, which deals with MACSEC and DeviceSec and network authentication. That actually helps mitigate to ensure that if a user gets on that system, obviously not a compromised system, but that a new system can't go on and cause IPv6 problems in the future. The second one is the layer 3, which deals with really the implementation or potential implementation of SendCGA and being able to support, as an example, RFC 6109, which is a router advertising option for DNS, or RFC 4861, or at very least 3315 from the authentication protocol that is built into DHCP but really has never been implemented. Lastly, you have your named trust model. Right now, the named trust model at layer 4 and above is really DNSSEC and implementation of DANE. But again, things that aren't actually happening from a trust model, it's causing a lot of problems and a lot of confusion in the market of where different technologies fit and where the best strategy is.
Well, it is confusing.
It's also important to note where routing advertisements are used. Routing advertisements probably are more useful to be used on a LAN. You could disable routing advertisements in a server environment where it's more likely that systems will have statically assigned addresses, statically assigned domain names, DNS servers, and a default router, statically defined. They don't need the dynamic routing advertisement.
So there are going to be situations, you're saying, where you're going to use RAs. You may use Slack, say, if you're on some kind of maybe you have an Internet of Things environment. Maybe you have, like, we had a facilities group, and you had devices that needed, you know, IPs. They automatically needed IPs, you know, to be managed, power equipment, UPSs, things like that. But you may not – you want to be selective about whether or not you turn on Slack, where you use router advertisements, and you still are you're still going to need DHCP. I think there's a lot of confusion about that. Maybe we can clarify that for people. especially when it comes to RDNSS, that you really need at least stateless DHCP v6 and probably stateful DHCP v6. Is that?
Yeah, that's a fair statement. That's a fair statement. Anyway, if you have anything dynamic, you need to get the array to get the router address. Then either you use on DHCP, stateful DHCP to distribute the address, or you rely on Slack, and then maybe on privacy extension, so those ever-changing addresses. And then anyway, you will need stateless, as you said, DHCP to give out the DNS server name and domain name and so on. Because RDDNS is an RFC, but as far as I know, it's not implemented into any host, neither Windows nor Mac OS 6, so it's pretty useless until now.
There was an open source Linux distribution of RDNSS.
Absolutely agree.
It worked well.
An essential problem with Slack versus DHCP version 6 is that originally they were supposed to be like alternative protocols to do the same thing, right? Now, the thing is that nowadays you have some things that are supported on one of them, some other things that are supported only on the other one of them. So the thing is that in practice, usually you need both of them, which is probably far from where... unfortunate, and that probably has to do with religious wars at the IETF as opposed to like real technical reasons for doing things that way.
Well, anyway, there are politics at the IETF.
No, go ahead. Politics at the IETF. We want to hear about that.
Oh, this is just one of the many religious wars, is the Slack versus the very, very pro Slack and the very, very pro DHCP v6. And you get into like the M and the O bits and the router advertisements, right? The things that drive whether or not a lot of hosts do DHCP v6 at all, and the pro DHCP v6 people light their hair on fire and run around the room screaming about that.
Can I mention the nice thing about at least Slack is if you're running in a cloud environment, your address allocation is very fast versus DHCP. So your service can come up faster, usually within a half a second, versus several seconds for DHCP. So you actually save a lot of time making services available if you're bringing up services and bringing down services in cloud.
Well, so it maybe then DHCP v6 versus Slack, it's more of an it depends kind of thing. It depends on what you're trying to do, right? I mean, in some situations, maybe you're going to be fine with Slack. In some situations, you're going to really need DHCP v6.
Well, without getting too much into the history, I mean, the reason you have Slack is when IPv6 was created, you had all the other protocols, right? You had AppleTalk, you had IPX, you had CLNP. So the idea is, why can't IP be more like IPX, for those of you who remember that, where you just plug in and it works? And that's kind of where Slack came from. Most organizations are still going to want DHCP v6 because if you don't do that, the privacy addresses everybody is mentioning and the temporary addresses mean with Slack, your node is going to generate a random address, and there'll be no attribution of that. You won't know who has that, which most organizations won't want, right? You're going to want to know who's using what address. And so most organizations are going to want to continue to use DHCP v6 so they can assign everybody an address and actually track who's using what.
Yeah, like when you mention Slack or privacy addresses to in an organization, the security team, usually it makes their eyes roll back in their head and they start frothing at the mouth and they have a fit. Right? Because
it's sometimes worth the cost of admission.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Because you can't, I mean, if you can't track that address end to end, I mean, and this is the other, I saw something, a thread about NetFlow data issues. Can somebody talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, NetFlow is one way of getting all the mapping between the Ethernet address, which usually never change, right, as well as with the port address on the switch, which never change, obviously. Together link with the IPv6 source address, so that's one way of getting this information, and then you can copy it into database for audit trail later. But there are other ways, right? At the IETF, we work with Fernando and others on the SAVI working group, so the source address validation improvement, which is a lot of techniques and heuristics where we can learn on the switch or the router, which is the v6 address linked to the Ethernet address, because if you don't use DHCP, you don't get a central administration for it, right? So a central repository. So you need to run it dynamically. And that's what service switches can do. Now that's an RFC and a couple of implementations are coming. So you can fetch on those switch through MIPS or through whatever, SSH or whatever, get the mapping between the Ethernet address and the IPv6 address, which is really, really important indeed for audit trail within an organization.
Yeah, it does, but you do agree that there are going to be some challenges in some of the old ways of doing things that you had before, where, you know, you had all that information and tools that easily got it for you. There, in addition to having your lab, you're going to need to be focusing on getting the same level of parity with your tools that you use to find top talkers, you know, trace addresses end to end. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. You're right. You will need something different there.
Just as an addition, it would be possible to actually, let's say, manage the address generation policy with Slack. And actually, we published a proposal a few months ago and actually presented that proposal at the last IETF meeting, essentially to add a couple of bits to the Slack packets so that the router could tell which sort of addresses hosts should generate. But, well, some folks were not really happy with the proposal. I don't know if that had to do with the real issues war between the HCP version 6 and Slack. Some of the guys that voiced opposition to that were guys from Microsoft. And on the other hand, we released, I think a couple of weeks ago, a network daemon to actually monitor the mapping between IPv6 addresses and link layer addresses. Of course, that changed the thing from the IPv4 wall, because in the IPv4 wall, essentially, those mappings were kind of like static, whereas in this case, you need a specific daemon to track that, but that's possible anyway.
Yeah, so... Well, Fernando, I've seen all the drafts that you've submitted. It's like it's a little scary how many IPv6 drafts you've submitted. I don't know when you find the time, but if you know, listeners should probably just go to your site. I'll have your links in the show notes, and they can see a virtual plethora of drafts, security drafts for IPv6. I think another point of discussion, I mean, we know that we need to get in the lab, we need to start checking our tools and, you know, start working with them to make sure we get the same level of information. How do you guys feel about where the vendors are with all of this and responsiveness? I've been following, you know, the discussions on the IPv6 hackers email list, and I've also been reading different things, and I was a little disappointed by one vendor who basically said when it came to implementing an RA guard like functionality similar to Cisco, they said, "Well, they need to fix the protocol. That's not our problem."
For the last 8 years, I've basically been polling everybody at Black Hat, every single vendor, and have been keeping notes, and they all fall within four different categories. One is no. No one is asking for it, and I always ask the question, so are you keeping track? And usually it's they say, well, no, we don't have anybody keeping track. The second group seems to be assuming that the underlying operating system for their appliance, as an example, supports IPv6, but when we get into discussions with things like, wow, there's hardware acceleration for your IPv4 TCP packets, does your hardware acceleration for your IPv6 TCP packets also work. In many cases, they don't.
What are you talking about? The TOE?
Basically, what we have, yes. We have the ability to do acceleration at the card level.
Right.
And a lot of the devices aren't doing that. So what happens is it gets pushed up to the operating system. Therefore, you can take a performance hit if you're not aware of that. A lot of these vendors are not aware of it and haven't even asked the question. The third thing I'm seeing is a lot of people saying, yeah, we have it on the roadmap, but they can never provide a roadmap. There are some companies that literally have been telling me for 8 years that it's on the roadmap and still have yet to deliver, which is pretty funny. So it's really frustrating. The last is some of the companies that are really being proactive, which I'm really excited about. Which are the companies that have been tested and are now listed on the IPv6 Ready or the U.S. government NIST website on tested products. Those are the ones that I've been trying to stick to because then I can actually determine what the best security mitigations to use versus the first three categories where I have no idea if the products even work.
Well, I know, Joe, you do a lot of government work. You work with – that's how we know each other, through Nova Hackers, and you work – you heavily
Nobody talks about Nova Hackers, remember?
Oh, right, Fight Club. But you do a lot of consulting for the federal government. So do you feel like they're in a better position than the public or with – as when it comes to IPv6, or is that they're just having a different set of problems?
What I find interesting is, unlike a lot of corporations, a lot of organizations, they determined in 2010 to create a acquisition regulation which required that all vendors selling products to the federal government had to support IPv6. This year, because a lot of vendors were claiming that they supported it, they're holding them accountable, and they actually have a supplier declaration of conformance,
Ooh.
What they call the SDOC. Which they have to provide with the sales as the sales cycle is taking place. So because of that, unlike a lot of the corporations out there who haven't done that process, they're starting to get companies to sit up and really consider this an important issue.
Well, you know, that was one of the best pieces of advice. I went to some vendor lunch and learn, and usually it's some opportunity to just try to sell you a product, of course, fair enough. But the first thing somebody said was that you should do an IPv6 inventory of everything that you're going to have in the path. And I thought that actually was great because it seemed obvious, but nobody does it, I think.
I mean, if I can interject one other little very related comment. Is also to keep in mind, right, not just defining what pieces of gear are there, that's obviously an important thing, but also what level or what functionality within IPv6 that gear needs to support, and can it do that V6 stuff as well as its ongoing current V4 stuff all at the same time, because, right, the majority of all of us will be dual stacked
right.
long before we go V6 only.
Yeah, because as you're inventorying all the devices along the traffic path, one of the things that might be in your traffic path is a web application firewall. And that web application firewall should be assessed whether it has any V6 capabilities at all. There are testing laboratories that validate, web application firewall products, but they don't test that it's V6 capable. When you go to V6 enable your website, is one of the first things you're going to try to do with IPv6. You need to understand that that product might have limitations with V6. You might be less protected with V6 on that website if it requires that web application firewall to present against some kind of web application vulnerability. And to Joe's point, there are testing laboratories that test products for V6 capability. Let's say they test firewalls. But they do the base minimum level of testing, just that the firewall performs as a stateful packet filter with IPv6.
Yeah,
but it doesn't test anything else that the firewall does. Like maybe you need your firewall to do some SSL VPN or it does some web content filtering or it has a built-in IPS. They don't test that any of those features are V6 capable or not.
Or I love when I'm sorry to interject, but I love when they tell you it's IPv6 ready. You look up, for example, the FWSM module, which a lot of organizations still have, and I'm betting they're still all over the federal government too, because it's hard to get an FWSM module out once it's like got its claws in your environment. No offense, Eric. Those things support IPv6 in software.
Yeah, that's exactly Joe's point, is a firewall services module doesn't have hardware acceleration, as Joe mentioned. So you need to know that that's a difference, and you need to be aware of that before you deploy.
Right. I should add that it's not only about the features and the performance, but it's also about the maturity of the implementation. So if you compare the maturity of V4 implementations to the maturity of V6 implementations, they are typically far from each other. I don't want to get into like politically incorrect claims, but in many cases, the maturity of V6 implementations are those of IPv4 in the 90s, if you know what I mean.
Wow.
On the other hand, right, for instance, if you, by the way, speaking for Cisco, FWSN, you should never, never use it in a real IPv6 network, right? We all agree on this one. That's a given.
Yes.
Couple of IPv6 stacks, mainly, I think, in routers and host operating systems, have been in the wild and in production for 7-8 years. So the maturity on the real router and switches is there. Now, and I do agree, on the web application firewall and the firewall is slightly different.
You know, I think that, well, there have been quite a few vulnerabilities mentioned on the IPv6 hackers mailing list, but it's pretty common to find in many implementations, both router and host implementations, to find things such as the implementations not checking the or not enforcing the maximum size on data structures. So it becomes trivial, for example, to perform denial of service attacks. And one of the probably most, famous cases was the side effect of an IPv6 address scanning attack. So you have an attacker trying to perform an address scanning attack to a remote network. And since the final router implementation doesn't enforce a limit on the size of the neighbor cache, it essentially grows without bounds, and you get a denial of service. So you find many of those things. And like a side comment, which at least makes me wonder, is that in many cases, I don't really have a list for that, but in many cases, vendors got their public websites V6 enabled only in June this year, or maybe June last year. So that should make you wonder when the same people selling the boxes, the devices, are not using that themselves.
Oh,
one
that's
of the big
not
challenges. Sorry.
No, that's just one, that's embarrassing, isn't it?
that's kind of embarrassing. If you allow me to replay on this one, but a vendor is like any big organization, and to be honest, there were 2 years ago not a big case of going to V6 for any website, business case, I mean. Mm-hmm. And Cisco, for instance, Cisco.com is the same as everyone, right? We've got budget, we've got IT people that we need to pay for. And then it took, for myself, which is basically an IPv6 person, it's way too long. But, okay, since 6th of June, we are there. And like the Microsoft and the Yahoo and the Google and so many others. We need to get, like everyone, an incentive.
But the challenge is a lot of people, instead of actually making their edge IPv6 capable, which includes not only inbound initiated HTTP and HTTPS, but also their email services and other, you know, VPNs and such, a lot of them ended up putting proxies in front, which really just converted the IPv6 on the outside to IPv4 on the inside and then allowed the application to come in. I found many vulnerabilities in the way people coded at the application level where they actually used IPv4 address sizes for their inside applications, which made my pen testing really easy for some of these applications that use this other strategy. Unfortunately, it looks like a lot of the vendors that did that last minute conversion actually used that particular strategy.
So are we saying that basically, so the common attacks that you're going to see for IPv6 are going to be man in the middle on the local LAN and denial of service. Is that fair to say? That's going to be the most?
Let me comment on the LAN one, Michelle. So I think, and Joe, I'd be interested if you know more, but my understanding of the RA TAC that I'm not going to pick on them, but that the two vendors are vulnerable to is it's a denial of service attack. So if you carry out the attack, you essentially render the machine unusable, but to the best of my knowledge, there's no exploit for it. So you can't actually own the box. You can just take it out of commission. So not to belittle that, but there's a big difference between that and something where you can actually exploit it and deliver a payload. So, Joe, do you know differently on that?
Oh, that's exactly right. I found some Java applications that used IPv6 or IPv4 cookies embedded, actually, in this case, hashed. So all I did was send wrong data to it with some semicolons in it, and boom, popped the shell. It was pretty sweet.
Oh.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your shell.
You'll have to write up, do a blog on that, Joe.
Attempting to get it fixed at the core from the libraries first, just like I did with the IPv6 firewalls on Linux, which when you enabled IPv4 firewalls, it turned off IPv6, and IPv6 firewalls turned off IPv4. Trying to actually get it fixed at the core so people have solutions for it. So give me a little while.
Okay. And what's this? So another issue that I've seen come up is VPN evasion. I admit that I wasn't really aware of that issue. And then the discussion came up on the mailing list. And so basically, we have our VPNs configured to not allow split tunneling, but then if you're running a V6 stack, there are VPN clients out there and VPN implementations that it doesn't matter. It'll just use V6. So you're not allowing split tunneling, but I guess it's split protocoling.
You're not allowing split tunneling of V4. Exactly.
Yeah. And that's basically what Scott and I have described in our IPv6 security book. It's no split tunneling is for IPv4 only, and a lot of very old IPsec clients, couple of Linux, the macOS native, and to be honest, the old Cisco one, simply do no split tunneling for IPv4 only. If you want to do NetBurgy, which was cool for printing locally, or IPv6, you simply bypass the no split tunneling policy. And that's right. Simply because all those IPsec clients has been developed in early 2000, where IPv6 was assumed to be in 5 years or 6 years, so nobody cares.
Well, yeah. It's kind of ironic considering that that IPsec is like an IPv6 thing, and
I do agree. Yeah.
So, Michelle, let me comment on that, because one thing that I don't think is well understood, maybe by everybody here, but not in general, is the reason that's an issue is because, if you go back to like the IPX days when network ruled, whenever you have multiple protocols, you need some kind of policy arbitration, right? So if I have multiple ways of talking to somebody, how do I pick which way I choose? And these are implemented in what's called a prefix policy. So if you look at RFC 3484, which is actually recently updated, but that's still what most people implement, that explains the default prefix policy. And so the reason issues like with VPN clients that ignore IPv6 or non-IPv4 protocols is an issue is because by default, my prefix policies in all operating systems that understand IPv6 prefer IPv6 over IPv4. So you can actually change that or alter that, but that's the issue.
Well, part of the question is how many people are aware of that and how many people would actually manually configure that to actually avoid the problem, right?
Knowing is half the battle.
And is there documentation on so I can modify? Are you saying I can modify this if I'm using the Cisco client?
I'll tell you what, Michelle. How about if I do a guest blog on packet pushers, because it's
awesome.
I don't know if Scott or Eric or somebody else wants to jump in, but I don't think I could explain in a couple minutes.
That would be great. Actually, I think a lot of the listeners would love to see that because, like you said, all our clients are, you're not turning off IPv6 on the clients. And if the stack is running, we'd like to know how to protect ourselves. I think that's important.
The other thing to watch.
And you're right. It's pretty important because any people using, let's say, a Mac or Cisco IPsec client going to a hotspot without any array guard can basically starting his IPsec client back to this corporation network. Anybody on the same hotspot can send a rogue array, turn on IPv6, and if the PC is vulnerable for any kind of attack with the Trojan installed, then the attacker can jump over V6 to the PC, jump inside the IPsec over IPv4, and go to the corporate network. That's, I think, the simplest way to explain it.
And I just had a heart attack. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's
a heart attack here.
That's actually been doable for a while.
Yeah. Nobody talks about it, though. I mean, I've been following, not, you know, because let's face it, we're all very busy if you're a working engineer and you're not following some of the newer protocols as much as closely as you should, because you're not actually doing it in the lab. So check, yes, you should have IPv6 in a lab so that you know about all this stuff. And when I saw the VPN evasion thread, I was like, what? I wasn't really on my radar, and I had been following, which is another point I'd like to bring up is, different transition protocols and tunneling protocols. I had been following, I was really aware of Teredo and what people could do with that and using that as an exfiltration mechanism, 6 to 4, you know, that if you're not actually going to use those tunneling protocols or those transition mechanisms, then you should be very aware and turn them off, or, you know, just have a conscious strategy for what you're going to do. But the VPN one was just not even on my radar. But so let's go about to the transition protocols and the tunneling mechanisms and what kind of problems those present from a security standpoint.
So with the tunneling protocols, I mean, I think everybody would agree you should just disable them. The only one, you know, I think for the majority of the audience, the only one that you might be interested in would be ISOTAP, which, like I said, should be off by default. But ISOTAP in particular is interesting because if you have older hardware, you know, we've already given some examples, and that hardware can't do IPv6 in hardware, it does it in software, it's essentially like it can't do it. So in those cases, if you need to push IPv6 out to networks behind that equipment, you can use ISOTAP, and you still want to limit it. You can basically do an ACL, you set up an Anycast gateway, you set up an ACL that only allows access to that Anycast gateway, nothing else, so at least you have control. But with 6 to 4 in Teredo, they should never run in an organizational network. I've never heard an exception.
The broader security issue here is that these tunneling techniques are enabled by default in the operating system without any end user or system administrator configuration. The operating system is V6 capable and may elect to use these tunneling techniques automatically. And there are security issues related to these. That's the broader issue, is that something has been auto-configured and can create communication between two systems in a way that maybe wasn't intended or is not known. So
are you saying that 6 to 4, for example, if what transition mechanism do you recommend? Because a lot of people are going to be doing 6 to 4 on their load balancers. They're going to like have IPv6 routing on the edge. They're going to come into a load balancer.
I think you're thinking of NAT 6.4, Michelle, and not
6 to 4. Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
The transition technique all of us would recommend is dual stack.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I think all those tuning techniques in 2012 are simply something from the 19th century or the 20th century. Let's be serious. We're in 2012. Dual stack is the only way to go.
So I give ISOTAP a little bit of a pass on an internal network. There are some valid use cases for that. 6 to 4 is usually going to be a non-starter anyway. It's protocol 41, right? It's not going to work through a NAT. Yes, it's on by default. You might want to change that. Teredo, of course, is the bad actor in the room, right? Does all the NAT traversal for you, you know, enabling bidirectional connectivity and all those other wonderful, great things. And just ignore all your security infrastructure. So that one you definitely want to make sure you manage and turn off and block.
TJ, the issue I think Joe and I have seen with 6 to 4 is that inside U.S. federal organizations that use public addresses for their internal network, 6 to 4 becomes activated because the host thinks it has a public address.
Exactly right. Now, and the only saving grace there should be that native V4 is still preferred, right? The rules of preference, V6 being better than V4. But V4 is better than automatically tunneled V6.
But sadly, yes, that depends. That depends on, older on the platforms patch within your hosts.
But yes, if you're using Sorry, if you're using public addresses internally, you have a specific problem with 6-4, and you need to go out of your way to block that as well, or disable it.
You know, and that's funny what you bring up, because when you talk to a lot of people are even confusing these transition mechanisms and tunneling protocols. They don't even understand them. I can't even claim that I fully understand them. I'm just thinking about what to block, you know, what's a problem. Oh, block protocol 41. Yep. You know, I don't want it coming in.
For what it's worth, 6-4 is a terribly chosen name.
I know. And then there's NAT64, which, like you said, yeah, that's actually what's being used on a load balancer when you're using it as for transition mechanism. I mean, it's, yeah, everybody confuses them. It's like they should have a Rosetta Stone of all of these, you know, so you can follow them. So, but to Fernando's point, just say no to tunneling and transition protocols. Run dual stack. Is that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Great. Yes.
One other challenge with NAT64 is most people, if you talk to them about double NAT, their eyes roll back and they don't want to deal with it. But just remember, with NAT64, you're actually translating between address families. So by default, you must translate both the source and destination. And it actually gets complex really fast, especially because of prefix policies. So there are corner cases like an IPv6-only network, you know, like, for example, if you're T-Mobile where it's interesting. But in general, you should tread carefully with that.
And then the extra memory usage with keeping all the track of all of that. Yikes.
And to come back on this NAT64, in the case of Internet Edge, a lot of people are using server load balancing 6.4, where a server load balancing at the application layer does protocol translation between V6 and V4. But at least in this case, the server load balancer can insert a specific HTTP header called X484, where you can keep track of the V6 address. So the legacy IPv4 server receiving the connection translated can still get access to the V6 address for accounting, for auditing, or whatever. So it's slightly better, but agreed.
Okay, so then we're slightly okay with using the load balancers for this with your in conjunction with your edge. Is that what we're saying?
That's correct. It's better than NAT64, in my opinion. For
security. Yeah, Fernando probably hates that, right? Are you frothing at the mouth, Fernando? He's like, no, make it all V6.
That wasn't a denial.
Well, in the document that we wrote about essentially what to do with transition technologies, I say that the bottom line is that you should make an explicit decision about what you're going to do. So the point is not really whether the recommended practice should be to block them or to actually, let's say, enable them or permit them. But actually, that either way, you should actually make an explicit decision. And in many cases, you find that in many networks, they are allowed, but not a result not as a result of an explicit decision.
Yeah, exactly. I've seen it in a few places. I mean, where it's just not on. I mean, if a security, I've talked to multiple security people who you mention the word Teredo and they still don't know what it is. And that just, I'm floored by that because I don't consider myself an IPv6 expert at all. I'm definitely a noob, but you know, you have to be under a rock at this point. And it's getting really critical that even if your organization is pooping it and saying no, 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 you still have to know about it. You still need to be very educated because the organization may be forced to turn on a dime and deploy it, or it's already running. They may have said no, but all the workstations are actually already running IPv6.
That's why you need a lab, because that is very frequently the case where organizations say we're not running it. And then we, you know, set up a lab, we, you know, do some education, and then I'm like, okay, now take this knowledge and go look in your network, and they're like, don't.
Yeah.
And so that's the justification.
And by the way, Michelle, one very good way for every listener is to enable NetFlow, GFlow, or whatever, in their network, and look for any protocol 41 or UDP 3544 for Teredo, or if they can look for Ethertype for H6DD, which is IPv6, they would be surprised. IPv6 is already in their network.
Yeah, you might be seeing it on your IPSs today. If you use NBAR2, you would be able to see that tunnel traffic and count it and quantify it. Yeah.
Okay, so you're saying that's the way to make the justification. Just prove to upper management, look, it's already here.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's there for a couple of years already.
Well, probably more than a couple, I guess. Yeah. So, I saw Arbor Networks released. Was it Jim? I think that sent me the link to that, to their last threat report. I mean, what they're saying is that there isn't a lot of IPv6 attacks in the wild right now. But is that just because of that's just not there isn't a lot of IPv6 out there in the wild?
I don't agree. A lot of instrumentation.
That's one point. And the other point is, it's not only about DOS. For sure, a DOS against V6 is kind of naive because you need to get – most of the DOS are run by botnets, and there is not a lot of penetration of V6 right now, so it's more efficient, a bit of a V4. But I've seen on my personal website, which is DualStack, like I guess like all the people in this call for many years, when I look into the log of my website, I've seen so many attempts to do SQL injection on my website for many, many years. That's there. The tools are simply ignorant whether they are attacking over V4 or V6. And in my case, they are attacking over V6. I receive as well email over V6. And tell me, I'm receiving phishing. I'm receiving viruses like all of us over V6.
Wow. So you're saying that you think that the tools to catch it just aren't mature enough, but that it's that there are a lot more attacks out there than what we actually are aware of.
Well, it could be one of two things. One, it could be the clueless attacker just types in a fully qualified domain name that happens to come back with a V6 address into their tool. They don't know whether their tool is using V4 or V6, and the attack actually takes place over V6 because Eric's website is V6 capable and has a DNS V6 address. Or it could be a clueful attacker is cluefully using IPv6 because the attacker may think that the system is less defended over IPv6. It's one of those two situations.
Well, Fernando, I'd like you to address the vendors with IPv6. We've talked about it a little bit, and I think maybe you feel like we've been too easy on them. And we're going to be, you know, granted we have somebody from Cisco here, but why don't you tell us how you really feel about vendor support and what's going on with that, especially when it comes to NATing, having such a stranglehold?
I think with the vendors, but as companies, of course, probably many of them see like a big opportunity of making money by means of selling CGA devices, right? And if you think about it, they could probably make money selling those devices and after that selling V6-enabled devices. So you shouldn't be surprised if other than the official policies of many vendors, some of them feel like pushing CGA in devices as opposed to, let's say, more aggressive IPv6 deployment. And I say that we shouldn't be surprised about that because companies are there for making money, right? And if you have the chance of selling, first of all, let's say, an expensive CGN device, and after that, a V6-enabled device, a company, of course, would do it. So I think that's part of the game that is not really usually mentioned, but I don't know if that has to do with people trying to be politically correct, but that's something that is playing here, I would say.
I guess my feeling is I wasn't so – I mean, you hear both sides of the conversation, you know, where – you know, I remember having a Juniper sales rep who – he was convinced there was a conspiracy, you know, a Cisco conspiracy against Juniper, you know, of the highest degree. I don't go to that degree. I have to say, we started a proof of concept where I'm working, and I felt really disappointed by the sort of lack of organization around, you know, I expected to see, for example, at Cisco and Juniper, you know, an IPv6 site, you know, a dedicated area of their website that was IPv6. I expected to see a list of hardware and recommendations. I mean, my expectation was that they were really going to be very organized and supportive for the community. And that's what disappointed me the most. Not so much, I guess, what you're saying, but I see both points. What does everybody else think?
Let me chime in for a second. So first of all, if you're going to pick on Cisco, I would like to give Eric credit because Eric demonstrated a man-in-the-middle attack in 2008 at Networkers, and that's actually what got me interested in IPv6. So there are a lot of people within Cisco, within Juniper, within other companies that know a lot. There is fantastic information on Cisco's site, although a lot of it is not as easy to get to as it should be.
I think
the real challenge is this. If you look at IPv6, it's not a product. I can't really sell you IPv6. I mean, maybe I can sell you education, maybe I can sell you consulting, but it's not really a product. It's more of an architecture. And so that's hard. So if I'm a salesperson and somebody's talking about this, theoretical abstract stuff, I'm like, okay, great, what's the product?
And I think that's a great point. You're right.
There's no simple answer. So, I mean, in their defense,
How do you market it? How do you make it sexy? Ooh,
I'll tell you what, if you figure it out, I'm thinking you're going to get some very lucrative offers.
That's a really great point. Thanks, Jim.
And by the way, Jim and Michelle, I think 4 or 5 years ago, I mean, Cisco started to give IPv6 for free, I mean, except for the memory extension, of course, and then we were followed by other vendors. So IPv6 brings no revenue for sure, but I think, speaking of Cisco, of course, but I think for other vendors as well, we do believe that the internet growth is key for the industry, I mean, for all of us, vendors and customers, and the only way to grow the internet is to go to V6. And for sure, right, I mean, my salary is partly paid by CGN, shame on me, but I will not give the money back to, to the community, right? But it's very, very small amount. And most of the CGN, at least, and I think, again, talking about Cisco and the others, can work as well for NAT64 and 6RD, so they are basically all transition mechanism. And the biggest hope for everyone is that those devices, we sell them right now in 2012 maybe, in 2014, they simply removed, powered down, and put into the bin. Right, because we don't need them anymore.
I will also say too, I'll try and find the link, but there have been a couple of studies done. There was a fantastic presentation by Time Warner at the North American IPv6 Task Force on all the problems that CGN brings. And one of the predictions out of their research was it will force universal deployment by the end of 2014, at least in the U.S., because it's so expensive to maintain and troubleshoot. And the other thing that the studies found is that it's actually cheaper to migrate your users to IPv6 than to try and sustain CGN. So CGN, I mean, I agree that there are some trying to make a quick buck, but everybody agrees that it's not sustainable, and the only thing that makes economic sense is IPv6.
Wow, so you're saying it could be a reverse conspiracy on Cisco's part? That it's a ploy to get people to move to V6 faster? Wow, that's a pretty brave statement there.
I don't know if I can pretend to be that clever, Michelle.
Well, so I guess another point is that after, hearing everybody talk, that if you don't care about IPv6 security, you may not care about IPv6, but if you're running any kind of, if you have your computer plugged in and you're running a network protocol, you think you're only running IPv4, you have to care about IPv6 security because you're running it. You just don't know you're running it.
Let me plug something too. I kind of like to thank Fernando and Joe for being reviewers. But right now, for free, you can go to NIST and you can get special publication 800-119. It's free and it's fabulous. It compares IPv6 to IPv4, so we'll help you learn it. And it goes through almost all the security items and is also probably the best reference to RFCs and IEEE documents that I've ever seen.
Oh, that'd be great. We'll definitely put that in the show notes then. That'll be great.
also for the network engineers that have to give something to their manager so they understand why they're moving. The federal government just put a way forward document coming out of the White House that dealt with the business justifications, why the government's moving, and strategies they're using successfully.
Oh, definitely want that in the show notes. That'll be great. Management, we all know senior management doesn't really get it yet until there's a real, where it's really obvious to them if, you know, unless you have an Asia-Pacific presence or that there's some definitive business need, they're just not getting it.
I got one.
Yeah?
So LTE, as you know, is IPv6, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's not as well known is the reason that IPv6 isn't as prevalent is because even though Android 4.0 or Ice Cream Sandwich supports it, most of the Droid phones are not up to 4.0 yet. But this fall, you're going to see a big ramp up in that. And also, Apple's iOS 6 turns on IPv6 support on the cellular side. So now you're going to have the major mobile platforms that are all coming out, right? The iPhone 5 is LTE. All these new devices are LTE. They're going to be running IPv6. And so when your executives get their nice new shiny phones or tablets with these LTE connections, which are running IPv6, how are they going to interact with your perimeter?
Oh, and don't tell me that. Then we have like all these more additional mobile security issues because of IPv6 on the phones.
That's probably another show.
Easily.
So. Oh, no. Does anybody have any – this sounds very negative, and this – you know, I think we've picked on IPv6 a lot, and we've picked on vendors a lot. Fernando, was there anything else mean you wanted to say about
– Well, I'll just say that it's not about getting scared. Actually, the job of an engineer is to actually make the technology work in the way you expect it to work, right? So there's a lot of work to do in this area, but, I mean – that's what engineering is about at the end of the day.
Oh, listen to you. That's good. Yeah. So, I mean, it has been, you know, this has been, it might be overwhelming for some. I mean, does anybody, who wants to bring us the good news?
Sure. So maybe I'm just the optimistic networking and security guy here. But I think it's definitely worth mentioning that V6 is real now, right? Some LTE devices have it already. But as a even more kind of a bringing it home example, I'm sitting here in Northern Virginia on a standard residential cable modem connection, right, with an off-the-shelf CPE firewall access point, you know, multi-service dealio thing doing all of its usual stuff. And right in this generic user type scenario, every single one of my many Windows, Linux, and Android devices all have native IPv6 connectivity right here, right now, no tunneling. It's all just there. It all just works. I didn't have to configure anything to make it work, right? Prefix delegation and DHCP v6. Just do all that. The blinky lights come on. I get connectivity. And I think that's, that's taken a long time for us to get to that point. And I'm not saying that every home service provider is there yet or every off-the-shelf CPE is there yet, but the fact that it's possible is a major step forward.
And we must now bow down to TJ.
Well, if you insist.
Well, but TJ is talking on Skype, which is IPv4 only.
Yeah, that's Microsoft's fault. We can all be in V6.
Yeah. I want to add one more thing. Research within the last year has been not only Internet of Things, but also resilience. From a security standpoint, how do you deal with multiple classes of attacks, and how do you fight through those attacks so you can protect your systems and make sure your operation stays up? It's a new concept that actually has been around for 6-7 years out of Carnegie Mellon, and now we're seeing lots of discussion about it throughout both the commercial and the government space. And IPv6 really provides some unique capabilities as vendors start realizing that it's not just about, you know, the 128-bit, numbers bits. It's not that. It's really really increasing the information sharing and collaboration horizontally and vertically across your infrastructure without in-between boxes that can cause additional attacks and slowdowns on your network. The ability to use IPsec host-to-host so you can create tunneled or tailored trustworthy spaces, that's a big issue. The ability to for moving targets where if an attacker comes after your network, the ability to very quickly readdress everything on the segment and, you know, let the attacker, because they only use addresses, they don't re-look up a DNS name, to be able to move it around. Additional authentication models that have been proposed for IPv6. Continuous monitoring becomes a lot easier in this domain. Authentication becomes a lot easier. Situational awareness. Attribution, being able to find out where in your infrastructure an attack is coming from or where outside it's coming from. And also privacy and interoperability. So there's some real benefits from a protect, detect, response, and recover for the security industry once we actually get there. The challenge is just to get the security vendors to enable IPv6, make sure their products don't crash in IPv6, so they can then see past that wall and actually see benefits of products that can be generated.
Well, I think this has been a really fruitful conversation. I really appreciate everyone being on the show and taking the time to talk to me. I know it was bigger than what we have for our normal show. I mean, we had a lot of people online, and sometimes it was difficult to get in. But I think this was great information for the listeners. I'd like to go around the table and just find out what everybody's working on right now. First of all, Fernando, because I know you just released a new tool on your website. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, we essentially release two different sets of tools. One of them is an IPv6 toolkit, which essentially allows you to send arbitrary packets, whether that's a router advertisement, neighbor solicitations, or anything. That toolkit is useful for security assessment, but it's also useful for troubleshooting. And in some areas, it complements probably the only other toolkit that there was out there, which was THC's IPv6 ADAC toolkit. And the other one that we released was an IPv6 address monitoring daemon. And the reason for which we actually developed that daemon was that we were hearing from people that it was hard for them to actually track the mappings between IPv6 addresses and the link layer addresses. And there was no daemon to do that, so we actually produced that one and released it. Both of them are released under the GPL license, so that's free software. And other than that, we have quite a few documents at the Internet Engineering Task Force with proposals for either best current practices or improvements to the protocols. From my perspective, even when sometimes I might make comments which might be, let's say, politically correct, I'm always from the perspective that it's not just about, you know, pointing fingers and just saying where the problems are, but actually I see my job as actually being able to come up with solutions to those problems. There's lots of work needed in many areas. For example, if you just write a document with a proposal on how to fix some problem, you still need programmers and vendors and so on to actually, you know, take action. But so that's why I think that it's not like a single man thing to improve the state of the current state of affairs. But there's lots of people from different areas that are needed to actually make things better. And I'd say that the bottom line is that we really need IPv6, and that's the reason for which we should all work to actually improve it.
And how can we follow you? What are the ways that we can follow you on the interweb, Fernando?
I have a Twitter that's at Fernando Gont, and we have a Twitter for the company, C6 Networks.
And you have a great mailing list, too, the IPv6 Hackers mailing list, correct?
Yeah, well, you know, the idea, Yeah, the idea behind creating a mailing list focusing on IPv6 hacking was that usually you get like very different communities. For example, you have the security mailing list such as Backtrack and Full Disclosure, which cover many, many different kinds of topic. And sometimes if you just want to focus on V6 security, you get lots and lots of emails that you're probably not interested in. On the other hand, there are other communities from operators or people working in the standards organizations such as the IETF that typically don't participate in security mailing lists. So the idea was to try to bring many, ideally all of them, to like a single place where we could focus on IPv6 hacking. The original idea was to focus on low-level stuff and code to help people produce tools, toolkits, and so on. But of course, well, the list has been up for about a year, and well, of course, we have had more like let's say abstract or more religious discussions. There have been others that were more technical, which were the ones that well, which were the reason for which the mailing list was to be brought up. We have about like 1,000 subscribers, more than 1,000 subscribers, which is like a nice thing.
Well, I hope we'll get you lots more subscribers, because I think that's probably, if I were going to, one takeaway that I would like to give people is I think that list, that's how I met all of these people. And so how we came up with this great discussion is through that list, that email list. And I'm going to make sure to have that in the show notes. So I'm sure we'll see you. We'll definitely see all of your IETF drafts, because there are many that are coming through. Eric, what will you be working on, and how can we find you on the interweb?
The easiest way is also through Twitter. I've got the Evinky account, so it's basically my username. What I am doing, multiple thing, right? I mean, it starts with working with the engineering in Cisco, because we have a wide portfolio of products, and we need to be sure that all of them got V6 in a secure way. When you have hundreds of products, it's not always easy. That's one point. I'm also working with training and educating customers, submitting with banks and public sector organizations, because as we have said during this call, V6 security is already a problem, or an issue at least, for many years for them. And we need to deploy V6 in a secure way, like all of us want to do.
And how you and Scott have written V6 books, is that correct? V6 security books, or?
That's correct. Scott and I did it, I mean, 2 years ago. It's covering a lot of things related, of course, to Cisco, because it's been published in Cisco Press, but it is a lot of things as well regarding BSD, Linux, and generic problems and Windows. So it goes much beyond, with a lot of practical example there. And it's still a kind of a very good reference there. And also what I am doing is talking to conferences like RSA Conference, which is a security conference, talking about V6. Mm-hmm. And the last point is like meeting every 3 months with Fernando and others at the IETF. And for instance, it's we have with other people from Google and others, we are proposing a draft about operational security issue with IPv6, so not about the protocol itself, but how you can operate an IPv6 network.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah, that's basically what I'm doing.
Scott? Any new books coming out, or?
No new books, but I've been just continuing to do research and development on IPv6 and security, helping to consult to organizations and help them deploy IPv6 securely. Doing training, as Eric and the others on this panel do, in conferences, by writing. I write a blog on Network World. You can just Google and see the things that I'm working on, but. Really trying to educate, get the word out about V6 security so people are aware of it and they know, you know, what kinds of things they can do practically to secure it from the onset.
And can we find you on Twitter, and what's your blog site?
It's networkworld.com/community/Hoag, H-O-G-G. My Twitter handle is Scott Hoag, all capitals. And then I'm involved in the Rocky Mountain IPv6 Task Force.
Great. And TJ, what are you going to be up to?
I'm just continuing the same consulting, training, engineering, cooking and bottle washing and whatever other V6 related tasks we have on hand, traveling around just enough. Sometimes it feels like too much, but just enough to make it still fun and interesting. You can find me online, the Twitters or the Google Pluses or whatevers at TREJRCO. And you can find my company in the same places, but with NEPHOS6, NEPHOS, and then the number 6.
And we'll have all of this in the show notes. Jim, what are you going to be up to?
So I like to hang out on LinkedIn. There's a pretty good IPv6 group there. And I second Fernando's group is awesome. And I like to do presenting. So I do consulting, and then I like to speak at conferences. And I am speaking at a user group in the Detroit metropolitan area on November 13th. And we're going to go through IPv6 more with a Unix, Linux, BSD slant. But we're going to kind of do a deep dive into, you know, why and how.
Awesome. And Joe Klein, what will you be up to?
Trouble.
As usual.
Yeah, pretty much looking at first resilience, kind of determining the trust models and determining how we can use IPv6 to really create the next version of secure infrastructure. And then on the other hand, really looking at the wave technology for transportation, looking at some of the security problems that IPv6, from a security and a privacy standpoint, that they actually hold. I see that that's probably the next big attack surface as it evolves, and I'd prefer to be there and try to, you know, help it along, try to fix it. You can get hold of me. My blog is scientifichooligan.me, and on Twitter, Joe Klein, K-L-E-I-N. And I want to second, it's been a real pleasure to finally talk to people that I have been watching and communicating with via blogs and everything else for many years. This is really enjoyable.
Yeah, I'd just like to reiterate how this was great. I think it's been great to finally get everybody together, and this has been a great conversation. Hopefully we can do this again. Sounds like Eric wants to go to bed, because it's 11 p.m. in Belgium. Well, I'd like to thank everyone for listening and hope you can follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers or hang out with the listeners on IRC at Freenode. Visit packetpushers.net to read blogs by the growing number of bots in the Packet Pushers Command and Control Network. Subscribe to our RSS feeds and donate to the show. Please, unicorn hunting gets really expensive. I'd like to thank this week's sponsor, NWLA, the Nerd Wrestling League of America. Remember to catch their events on ESPN for Geeks. Email your comments or questions about this show to packetpushers@gmail.com or healthyparanoia@packetpushers.net. And remember, it's healthy paranoia because sometimes they really are out to get you.